I don't want you to go out there and figure out a new way to do what we do. I want you to follow what we've proven that works, and then we'll feed you work. The marketing arm will bring in the work, and we'll fill up capacity, and we will double in 3.5 years.
And that, folks, is right there one of the reasons why you want to have a good CFO who is helping you make sense of your data and helps you scale up your business so it actually becomes a more profitable, more sellable law firm, because one day you're going to retire.
You are listening to the Grow Law Firm podcast, where each guest shares actionable, practical ideas with you on how to get more clients, expand your reach, and grow your law firm's revenue and profit. Here's your host, Sasha Burson.
Hi there. I have a small but really meaningful favor to ask you. You know, I watch At The Stats on our YouTube channel and Spotify channel, wherever most people listen and watch our podcast, and I see that over 80% of everybody who listens to it regularly is not a subscriber. I'm asking you to subscribe to this channel, and the reason for that is my mission and the mission of my team is to help as many small law firm owners to learn how to transform their law firms into better businesses, and so they in turn enjoy better lives. When you hit subscribe button, you tell these platforms that this is content worth listening, worth viewing, and they in turn will show it to many other small law firm owners and hopefully help me fulfill our mission of helping them create a better business and enjoy better lives. So would you please do me this favor? It would mean the world to me. And hit the subscribe button. And my promise to you is that I will continue to work hard at creating good content with practical ideas that help you and your teams grow better law firms. Thank you. Welcome to another podcast episode of GLF, where we talk to amazing service providers who help law firm owners, ambitious law firm owners, grow their businesses. Today, I have an amazing guest here with me today. John Scott is a partner at Anders Consulting. He is a CFO who helps attorneys accelerate growth, navigate change, and achieve success. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sasha. Great to be here.
John, I understand you've been at it for something like 32 years, if I'm not mistaken.
I am very experienced. That's the HR way of saying I'm older.
How did you get into this line of work, and what led you to actually working specifically with law firm owners?
You know, I started in 1992 with Anders, which was at the time a very mid-size Midwestern firm. And we seemed to get all of our referrals from attorneys. We had a lot of attorneys around our offices. And so I met and worked with a lot of attorneys. And I was very fortunate in the 90s to meet a very entrepreneurial attorney who decided early on he didn't want to work in his practice, but rather wanted to grow it and work on his practice. He read the E-Myth books. He was a voracious reader, and he decided to define processes and make it so that he could grow and scale his practice. And he was able to do that across the entire country. And for 17 years, I participated in his finance committee meetings, and I watched him make data-driven decisions. And once he had the secret sauce about how to open an office and make it profitable within 6 months, he was able to just keep replicating that. He made some mistakes, but because he was paying attention to the data, he was able to course correct very quickly and not make those mistakes compound themselves into something that was bigger.
Is his name John Morgan?
No, but it's a similar story to John Morgan. I mean, Morgan & Morgan, I would love to meet John Morgan. I haven't done it yet, but it's a similar entrepreneurial spirit.
Got it. Are they in personal injury space?
They are not. It's a different niche of law. And in fact, I just ran into another firm in the Northeast that is following the same model. They're doing a different type of, it's not PI work, but it's litigation work. And they're following the same model where they figured out if we find the right managing attorney in another area that has a concentration of this work, they go and they acquire that person, hire him, make him a partner. A lot of times these are partners in name only, right? Because you're going to follow our system, but they can make that area, they can grow that area, and they can just stair step across the United States. It's really figuring out the process of what works and what doesn't. And not everybody's going to want to grow across the country. But if you want to just grow what you have, you have to pay attention to data and figure out what works and what doesn't. And if you are, let's say you are a firm that relies heavily on advertising, you have to figure out what works. I mean, sometimes the radio ads are really good. In fact, one firm we had did heavy radio ads and figured out that they could turn it off one month and turn it back on the next month. And there was no degradation in the amount of leads that came in. Now, the radio folks don't like that because you're cutting their ads in half, but it was a unique experiment that did work.
Yeah, that's such an amazing testament to opportunity to scale a legal business, which very often when we speak with law firm owners, they say, yeah, but my business is different. This is not scalable. If I was in PI, if I did this or if I did that, it would be scalable. But legal business is like any other service business. If there is demand and there is supply, you can scale. If there is no demand, you can't scale it. But if you sell, if you offer, if you provide estate planning services in Chicago where I am, you can scale to St. Louis where you are. And then hop over to Kansas City and the next town and the next town, or however you decide to expand geographically. But it is very scalable as any other business. And I don't think that people really realize that.
I totally agree. I mean, old world law and big law, silk stocking firms is reputational based. But if you're delivering a service, you're meeting a need of the community, and you figure out the way to do it in a profitable manner, you can replicate that either within your geographic area by opening up other offices or going to another city and doing the same thing. Once you've figured out the process and you've refined your internal processes from intake to the end of the client matter, including collecting the fees, you can do that everywhere. And those are all things that more experienced attorneys that have been around for a while, they don't focus on that. They focus on doing the work that's in front of them, not realizing that they could be incrementally better and getting incrementally better, more cash flow and net income just by refining processes and paying attention to the data.
Oh, that's interesting. So your slogan is accelerate growth, navigate change, and achieve success for ambitious law firm owners. How does a CFO contribute to that success? How do you help them scale up? And by the way, I think it's worth also talking about to a lot of attorneys, a lot of other business owners, it's hard for them to tell the difference between an accountant and a CFO. What's the difference? Let's start there. What's the difference?
Okay, your accountant is historical in nature. They look backwards, where a CFO consultant looks forward and tries to predict the future. And I liken it to when your grandfather took you on a vacation. The night before he took the family on the trip, he pulled out a 10-year-old atlas. He made some notes, and the next morning they took off in the family station wagon. And he could only react to what happened in front of him. If there was road construction that wasn't in the 10-year-old atlas, when he saw it, then he could make a course correction. Today we have Waze and Google Maps that anticipate, hey, 2 miles up ahead, there's a stalled car and it's slowing traffic. And oh, by the way, here's a workaround. So the consulting side of the accounting profession, which is the future, has good, clean financial data and can predict what's going to happen in the next 12 weeks, 6 months, a year, and keep you on path to achieving your goals. So in other words, if we're in April and we're an hourly billing firm and we see that people are not hitting their charge hour expectations, if we wait until October to make a course correction, to manage those people correctly, to do the work that's already available, we don't have enough time to get back and achieve our goals. But if we pay attention to the charge hour expectation and what people are actually charging, and we see that we're deviating from our goal in April, we have plenty of time to course correct. But if you're not paying attention to the data, and I've seen many firms, including accounting firms, that don't pay attention until the fall, it's too late. You cannot achieve your goals by not paying attention until the end of the year. You have to do it along the way. And by doing so, you're going to meet or exceed your goals that you've set at the beginning of the year.
How often should law firm owners meet with their CFOs and review data and forecasts?
At least monthly, if not on a weekly basis. And it wouldn't always be the same person in the firm meeting. We focus on four financial areas: cash, financial, production, and pipeline. And if we're fully engaged with a firm, we're going to meet on a weekly basis on one of those four topics. So it starts with cash position. How much cash do you need to operate your firm? And have you left enough behind so that you're not relying on debt to run the firm? And then once we set those targets for our cash position, let's say we're short of that, we need to build up to that. It might take a year to get there, but we need to build up to that cash target and then have less reliance on the line of credit or term debt. And then the next step is good, clean financials so that we can know at any one time what our cash position is, as well as compare it with a year before at the same time to determine some trends. And then we focus on production. Are we getting what we expect out of the talent that we've hired to do this, including the partners? I had a firm that the two partners hadn't taken a draw in 6 months. They couldn't figure out what was going on, and they were so busy putting out fires that they weren't doing their own client work. So when we got hired, we came in and pretty quickly diagnosed that no one was hitting their charge hours, including the two partners. It took about 2 months for them to manage their people and manage themselves, send out bills and get cash rolling in, but they started taking draws again. And then the last area is pipeline. If I don't know what my capacity is for work, I don't know how much activity I need to generate to come in. For instance, if I have, let's say, $200,000 of capacity in my firm and I only close half of my engagements, half of the people that come in hire us, I need $400,000 in the pipeline in order to fill that capacity. But let's say I'm at capacity and I don't have the ability to hire anyone yet, that next matter that comes in, I can afford to be more selective. I can say yes or no based on my needs, because what I really want to get to is having a whole firm full of A clients, people that are happy to engage with us. They communicate, they pay our bill by return mail. And if I can't hire additional talent, I can't get more machines on the factory floor to do client work, then I can selectively just work with A clients. But ultimately, you have to know what your capacity is and what the pipeline, where does your work come from, how does it come in order to determine whether or not to take the next new client.
Mm. What is a typical size revenue-wise of your new clients?
You know, I'd say $1.5 million to $30 million in revenue. Once you get much beyond, well, it is a big range, but once you get beyond $30 million, most of those firms have hired their own in-house talent. And we love the firms that graduate away from us because we've helped them grow along the way to be big enough to have their own in-house talent.
What's the median size? Is it trending lower, smaller, or toward that $1.5 million, or is it closer to $30 million?
No, it's probably on the lower side. You know, probably $3 to $5 million.
So imagine $4 million law firm. Let's take an average of that one. What are the common three problems that you see with those law firms?
Well, $4 million firm is probably 10 to 12 billing attorneys, and it's really defining roles and keeping people in their lanes, right? You have people that are in charge of management. They're going to have less charge time than the folks who are just line partners or staff attorneys. And it's really making sure that everyone is working to their highest and best use, putting people in the right seats on the bus so that you can focus on what you're really good at. And then really, the ALA survey from about a year ago said that 4 out of 5 law firms are open to and are outsourcing some non-legal function of their practice. And when we think about attorneys, their entry point to law school typically was not accounting or finance. So what they're really good at is serving client needs. If you're willing to then say, okay, I'm not really good at the accounting piece of this, outsource that or hire the talent in-house and then let that talent synthesize what's really important so that you can only focus on areas that are problematic. If you get a set of dashboard KPIs that tell you, hey, our cash position is good, but our AR is getting a little stale, then you can focus just on that internally. If it is a function of we don't have the charge hours and it's because we don't have the work, then you can focus on the marketing piece of that. But if you don't have that financial data and that dashboard of KPIs, it's tough to know what to focus on.
Well, something really interesting there that I do talk about quite a lot, and that is a $4 million law firm. You said that there are probably 10 to 12 attorneys, if there are 10 of them. So they're averaging $400,000 in collected revenue per attorney, give or take. And their income should be somewhere in the neighborhood of 30-40% of what they're collecting, give or take, for the law firm to stay afloat.
Agreed.
Not so expectations of most folks who think about lawyers as profession is that these are very high income earners, which by this math, they're not. Yet I'm sure that in your practice, you see a lot of very successful attorneys who beat those averages by a big, big, big factor. What's the differentiating factors when it comes to those very high income earning attorneys versus the most?
Leverage. The folks that, if you had that 10 person firm doing $4 million with two owners, they have better leverage than most law firms. So leverage is how many folks are working underneath a partner on those files. Most law firms have, the best law firms have leverage of 3-1. Many law firms are 1-1. So the bigger firms might have one partner, one associate. So the more successful the partner is going to be, they're going to have more non-partners underneath of them working on their files. So I'm not going to pay a staff attorney like a partner. So more of that profit will be allocable to fewer partners. Now, I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't make new partners, because we can judge the health of a firm by the average age of their partner group. If I have a firm of 10 or 12 people and two are partners, 10 or not, then if those two partners are in their late 60s, that firm is not, it's not going to be able to go on to the next generation. They're going to wind down. Maybe their files will be acquired by another firm, but you really want to see a partner group that has some more experienced people, some middle-aged folks, and some younger folks coming up. But to answer your question, the better the leverage, the better the net income for the partner is.
Yep. That makes a lot of sense.
On the PI side, I mean, those numbers can be wildly skewed because they're working just as hard as the hourly billing attorney, but the payday, the risk is bigger, but the payday can be bigger on those PI cases as well.
Got it. So those are the proverbial rainmakers who are bringing in all the cases, but spend a fraction of their time actually working on the cases and would rather go and build relationships that bring in additional cases rather than work the cases.
Right. I had a partner in our firm years ago would say, I'll catch him, you fillet him. So that was his method. He was a rainmaker. He would bring it in and feed, you know, 9 or 10 of us work, and we would work it, and you know, that's how we grow.
Yeah, it's a hell of a lot more profitable, at least personally profitable, to work on biz dev than to do the actual work. And it's the truth, because when you do the work, like, your time is not scalable. You're there working on the file. When you're going out there shaking hands, drinking coffees, having lunches, swinging golf clubs, it's a hell of a lot more scalable.
So let's talk for a second about why lawyers are reluctant to utilize leverage. One, they don't trust that the younger person can do it the way they would do it, and they don't invest the time in training that person, when in reality, that's short-sighted. You need that person to become better and better, and it frees you up to go do higher-level things, like bringing in the next great client and doing higher level client work. So the more you can push down, the more you can train and trust your people to do it the way you would do it or the way the firm thinks is the best practice, the more you have the ability to move upstream and do higher level things like bring in new great clients.
Yeah, I always look at it this way. So every year I have a marketing company that's now about 80 people strong. And every year, one of my goals is to fire myself from another big responsibility. Every
That's
single
awesome.
year, every single year, I'm replacing myself with another manager, another person who is going to do this full time better than me, or at least at 80% as good as I did. And over time, they'll become better than me.
And you are building a team that will outlive you. At some point, you can transition that business via sale or otherwise, and you'll be able to know that the organization is still going to be strong and vibrant.
Right. So like moving up that org chart every mm-hmm. year is a must, because I, as an equity partner, when I started at this company, it was already 10 years old and I'm 6.5 years into it. I wore 17 different hats. It was crazy. Right. My hair was always on fire from switching hats so quickly.
And your life is so much better now because you have people that you've trained and trust.
So much better. So I did selling for years. Then I switched to managing the sales team. They're doing a lot better with me out of sales directly than they did when I was selling. And I was a really good sales rep. But guess what? I wore 17 other hats.
Well, I applaud you, because that's tough for a lot of entrepreneurs to
own the way.
Push down those responsibilities and then trust and not get back involved.
Oh, but I look at it. So it's not just pure trust, right? You hire really good people who have experience. They have that proven track record. And once you hire them, you become their coach. And when you become their coach, it doesn't mean that you meet once a month to do performance review. I meet with them 5 days a week.
Right. You're for constantly half hour. Touching and gauging what's going on.
Exactly. It's kind of like if I was coaching a football team, I wouldn't wait till Sunday to figure out if they're any good. That's too late. I'm there Monday morning and Tuesday morning and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. I'm always there. And I'm looking at the data. I like data. But so I didn't go to law school. I went to University of Illinois and I was a finance major. So I do like numbers. It helps, right? But anybody can learn this stuff. This is no rocket science, especially
you are
with
so right. Anybody can learn it. You have the financial background, and U of I is a very good school.
Yeah, but it's University of Illinois, Chicago, not Champaign. So it's not that good of a school. But the truth is, so I went to school 25 something years ago, and the amount of practical learning that I did in college, in comparison to what I can learn on YouTube today for 2 hours, like just spending 2 hours, like that whole college experience was absolutely inconsequential for being good at business.
Compared to your experience in business.
100%. But today, again, like you can learn so many things on YouTube, but not 2 hours, 4 hours, practical stuff. Like, or you want to understand how P&L and balance sheet and statement of cash flows are connected, 40 minutes.
I love the YouTube example. My third child, we have a farm, and he put regular gas in a diesel engine. And he called me and he said, "Hey, I screwed up." And, I didn't chew on him too bad. I'm like, "Gosh darn it. You should have listened." He goes, "I got it." And he went on YouTube and he figured out how to drain the fuel and put the diesel in. He goes, "I fixed it." I'm like, "Wow, that's awesome."
Yeah. I have three kids. Two are old enough to understand how to use YouTube, 17 and 14-year-old. And whenever they come to me like, "How?" If I'm not uniquely qualified to teach them how, I'm like, you know what the answer is? YouTube it.
Look it up. YouTube it.
YouTube it. YouTube. Somebody already figured out. Somebody figured out and made a video. It's a 2-minute video. It's a 3-minute video. Go figure it out. For business, it's kind of the same thing. The only thing is that I find that in a lot of things, I do not want to know the how. I'd rather have somebody who knows the how and knows it a lot better than I do and can be there 5 days a week helping me do that how, so I don't have to worry about it. But I want to know what are the right key success factors and what are the right KPIs for me to measure their performance by. That's kind of like what I need to know. Beyond that,
that's where a consultant can come in and help, because they're going to develop those KPIs with you and then put them in front of you on a monthly basis so that you can say, okay, these two areas are good. This one we need to pay attention to. They're focusing your time on what needs your attention.
Yeah, 100%. So let's imagine that you and I move to the state of Arizona and we decide to partner up and buy a law firm. I think Arizona, as of this recording, summer of 2024, is the only state where non-lawyers can buy a law firm. So we decide to buy a law firm and we aim at 4,000 million dollars mark. And there are 10 attorneys there, and tomorrow we're buying it. And you, John, come up with a plan, like three big things that we're going to do to scale it up to $8 million in the next, well, call it 24 to 36 months. What are we going to focus our time, energy, and budget on to accomplish that?
We're going to come in and we're going to look at their processes. We're going to see if they're documented. If not, we're going to document and refine those processes. That's step number one. Step number two, we're going to get the financial house in order and get the data set. And then we're going to start recruiting. Because once we figure out the formula of how we make money and how we can increase making money, the impediment's not going to be, is the work there? The impediment is, do we have enough staff to do the work? And we should always be in the recruiting mode. We can always say no to a new hire, but I would rather hire ahead to know that I have good people in the stable so that I can go do that new work that we're going to go out and get. So we figure out what the processes are, the financial data piece, where does the work come from, and then what do we need to feed to get that work in here? But if I don't have the staff to do it, I can't do the work. And that leads to unhappy clients. So you should always be in the recruiting mode, especially in these days of it is so hard to attract and retain people, especially for smaller firms. The big firms can recruit all day long because kids coming out of law school want to go there. The smaller firms are at a disadvantage when they're looking to attract and retain that talent.
So optimizing processes arguably would help us make us more profitable, right? Maybe we didn't need 10 attorneys to begin with, because at $4 million with optimized processes, maybe we could get away with 9 or 8.
But we have capacity now.
But we have capacity.
We fill, right?
How do we scale up from 4 million to 8 million? I understand that you're not a marketing guy, but like in your practice, having worked with, I don't know how many, dozens or hundreds of law firms, what have you seen that works for scaling up, growing the revenue?
Well, the reason I say the processes are so important is because the next office I go to, I've already got the playbook of what works. This system works. If you follow the system, it will work. And then the marketing piece has to bring in that work to fill up that capacity in the new office or expanding the current office. That's why I say process is so important, because I don't want you to go out there and figure out a new way to do what we do. I want you to follow what we've proven that works. And then we'll feed you work. The marketing arm will bring in the work and we'll fill up capacity, and we will double in 3.5 years.
How long does it take to, like, let's take that small-ish law firm of $4 million. How long does it take to document? And I assume that most of them do not have thoroughly documented processes, but let's say, how long does it take to document them and optimize them, thinking that it's 10 attorneys, a bunch of support staff? Like, what does it take to do that?
You know, it doesn't take long to document what we're doing. It takes a little bit of time to figure out if it's the right process or if there are refinements we can do. But the biggest obstacle is buy-in, right? I need everybody to say, this is the best practice for this type of activity in the law firm, and everybody's going to do it. The big problem here is if I've got, you know, 3 or 4 partners and 2 are on board with following the best practices, and the other 2 want to have exceptions for their client base. I can't have that. I need to have buy-in that this is the way we're going to do it. And it comes down to engagement letters. They're all going to be standardized by client type or client matter. And so I can't have renegades that want to say, well, but on my clients, I want to do it this way. We had it in our own firm. We have letters that go out, engagement letters and transmittal letters with returns. And, you know, one person wanted Mr. So-and-so and best regards, and one person wanted sincerely and their signature block at the bottom. And we said, no, we're not going to do that. Sometimes you have to let the older partners age out, you know, because you're not going to change their ways. But if you can get buy-in from 90% of the partner group on those processes, then you can avoid the pitfall of, well, we have these processes, they're documented, but nobody's following them.
Yeah. Goes to that old saying, how we do anything is how we do everything.
Exactly.
So either there's consistency or there's consistent inconsistency.
And I can't scale inconsistency.
Cannot. Well, you can, but it looks like a nightmare and everyone's hair is on fire. And you can't sell it. It's not a sellable business. Nobody wants it.
Okay, so back to the law firm that you and I are buying in Arizona, and we're going to double it in size. I want to make sure that the name is something that is not dependent on a personality. Morgan & Morgan is a great thing. I'd say the one drawback is it's Morgan & Morgan. And so John Morgan is the face of that firm. And I guess they can keep John Morgan's commercials around forever, but I would much rather have it to have the name that isn't associated with somebody's last name.
He's gotten to the size, to that scale, where once he gets out of this business, I think he's going to be okay. There's a great example that's out of a different industry. Chicago has one of the best-known carpeting company called Empire. And there was a gentleman who was their mascot, so to speak, for decades and decades. And then he passed away about 15, 20 years ago. And guess what they did? They took his character and they turned him into a cartoon.
That's awesome.
His spirit still lives on now through new commercials. Same guy, same master, same glasses, same everything. And he's been gone for 10, 15, maybe 20 years. So I think that John Morgan, with his like nationally recognized brand, with 750 plus attorneys and $1 billion in revenue, but when we talk about small law firms, I agree.
Right. I mean, if it's our law firm, it's John and Sasha's firm. That's tougher terrible. To sell, you know, to someone else.
And for marketing purposes, which I know very well, nobody knows what Sasha and John do, right? But if it's family law, St. Louis or family law, Chicago or whatever it is, I mean, I know what they do. They're divorce attorneys, mostly.
Right.
Right. Or personal injury, Chicago, et cetera, et cetera. So 100%. Any other insights that folks should know to make their businesses more scalable and more sellable?
You know, I think a buyer of a firm, whether it's an attorney or we get to the point where non-attorneys can buy firms, wants to be able to rely on the financial statements, and having good current financial statements and a history of those so that you can see trends, you can see the growth, will give the buyer a lot more comfort in what they're buying. Many times you buy a business that doesn't have good books and records and you say, okay, here's my price, but I want to hold back for X, or we'll have an earnout. I know you said you've been growing 17% a year, but I really can't tell that from the financial statement. So I'll give you X up front. And then if we continue that growth that you've told me is real, then you'll get the rest of the money. So I think the fact that if you have good, clean financials with a good history of good, clean financials, the buyer is more likely to give you a better price and more of it up front, less contingent upon the future.
Yeah, and I think good financials, and I'm definitely not a CFO, but I recently went through this somewhat painful experience process in our own company, and that was, we had a very generic P&L, profit and loss statement. For those who do not know, you show your revenues, you show your cost of goods sold, you show your expenses, and then there is that net income, et cetera, et cetera. And what we had, it was generic. It was not broken down by departments, but we have departments. And for better financial controls, our fractional CFO and we had to go through the very painful process where we actually broke it down by departments. Everything. Last six quarters, everything is broken down by departments. But now look at data and I'm like, I'm supposed to be spending this much on marketing as a percentage of my revenue, this much on selling, this much on production, this much on this and this much on that. And now I can actually create budgets for each department and kind of forecast what's going to happen in that future because I have 6 quarters of data that is very clean and broken down by departments. And now I understand where I'm under budgeting and where I'm overspending.
Right. And the beauty of that forecasting is it's telling you where you're going so you can make those decisions. But the other benefit of having a standardized chart of accounts that's tailored to your industry, so in this case, law firms, is that you can then benchmark yourself against not only similar firms in your area, but similar firms nationally. So law firms are not all equal. Family law is different from PI, different from, mass torts. And class action suits. So you want to be able to benchmark yourself against the same type of firm, similar size of firms, and same geographic region of firms. So if you have a chart of accounts that's non-standard, you really don't have good financial information to compare to those other firms, your competitors.
Well, that makes sense. Where would you get industry standards for benchmarks? Is that available data, open available data there?
It is tough to get. Clio. I don't know if you're familiar with Clio, their case management system.
Yeah.
They put out some KPIs and some data. And I went up to the leader of Clio at, there was a conference in New York. It might've been Tech Week. No, Tech Week was in Chicago, but he was in New York. It was Legal Week. And I said, you know, I read your report and utilization you guys were crowing was at 38%. I said, I got to tell you, I don't know any law firm with 38% realization. Have you considered the fact that a lot of your users don't charge time? And it was like it blew his mind. Nobody had thought about that. And the Clio report said, oh, this is historic. 38% utilization, it's creeping up, it's going to be great. Nobody can make money charging 3 hours a day. So you got to look at that data and say, is it real? There's a lot of sources of partial information. We're putting together some KPI data with our own client base, and we're right now trying to formulate a short survey that would go out to many different law firms and say, look, if you participate, give us your utilization, your charge hour expectation, realization, and other data points. I'm going to keep it, you know, to 10 or 12 questions that will share with you the results of the report. And if we can do that on an annual basis, but it's really tough to find consistent, good information on law firms.
That's what I found, but it's interesting. You brought up that data. So Clio says 38%. Well, let's call it 40%. What's an average billable hour that you're seeing? I know it's very different across practice areas and geo markets, but let's just throw like out an average number.
A billable rate, standard rate?
Yep.
Depending on the area, you know, $250 to $400 an hour.
Can we average it out to a lower end of $300?
Yeah, we'll call it $300.
Okay, $300. You know, when we talk about a $4 million law firm, 10 to 12 attorneys, we're going to call it 11. So average billings per attorney is about 360.
Right.
And then we take $300 and it looks like they're billing for about 1200 hours.
Well, you have to look at realization too. They're not going to collect every nickel they bill. And that's good true. Realization would be 90%. Mm-hmm. Many firms have much lower realization than that because at the end of the day, the partner who's sending out the bill has to determine is there value there. And so if you're not at that 90%, you might only be getting 75 or 80%. Some firms get 50%. So that's where if somebody was getting 50% realization, I'd say their processes are broken, right? They haven't trained enough. They don't have people being efficient enough on client matters to get a higher realization. So 90% would be the gold standard. And, you know, are they charging, you know, if I set a charge hour expectation of 1600 hours and they're charging 1400 hours consistently, there's one of two things going on. Either they don't have the work and then I can't really judge them harshly for that, or they have the work and they're not doing it. So I'm not being managed correctly.
Yeah. And that focuses right there. One of the reasons why you want to have a good CFO who is helping you make sense of your data. It helps you scale up your business so it actually becomes a more profitable, more sellable law firm because one day you're going to retire one way or another, by default or by design. And it's a hell of a lot more profitable to retire by design than by default. I'm just told him. I'm retiring because that's it. End of the road. Nobody's here to buy my business. So very interesting. John, if people want to connect with you and see how you can help their law firms scale up and become more profitable, how would they connect?
You can reach out on LinkedIn at John C. Scott CPA. I'm with Anders Minkler Huber and Helm. It's Anders CPAs and Consultants, and I am part of our business is Summit Virtual CFOs by Anders. So I run the legal niche. I've written a book that I think we provided you. If we haven't, I'll send you a code for that. It's called Judicial Dollars and Cents, and it's available on Amazon.
I love it.
It goes through a lot of what we talked about in the four financial metrics that we focus on.
Terrific. There you go. John, thank you so much for being part of the show and sharing your tremendous insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sasha. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Grow Law Firm podcast. If you liked the ideas shared in this episode, help a fellow lawyer out by sharing a link to the episode. This episode is powered by the team of experts in client attraction, growlawfirm.com. Do you want a complimentary growth plan for your law firm? Request it at growlawfirm.com/blueprint.